Stands. We're taking everything with us. He stood up briskly, cursing himself for drinking too quickly as the beer rushed to his head. We'll manage, he said encouragingly, and left the hall in the direction of his chamber, swaying slightly as he walked. Feeling rather too full and somewhat light-headed, he stretched out on top of his bed and fell to thinking about the small silhouette that had darted past the door. He was sure he recognized it from somewhere. Suddenly, he was assailed by doubts. I hope we'll really manage. What have I let myself in for? Tired from hours of walking, he fell asleep in his clothes. Tungdil was roused from his dreams by a vigorous shake of his arm. He sat up blearily and groaned.
I thought dwarven beer wasn't supposed to give you headaches.
They've gone, he heard Belendilin saying. Tungdil, are you listening to me? They've gone. He opened his eyes. The High King's counselor was standing at his bedside, with Bavrogor, Goimgar, and the twins in the background. They were clad in their mail and looked ready to leave.
What are you talking about? They're behind you, murmured Tungdil, struggling to move his tongue.
Not them. I'm talking about Gandagar. His party has left. This time Belendilin's voice was louder and sharper. You'll never catch them if you don't leave now. Tungdil slid out of bed. His body and mind were in no fit state to embark on a high-speed journey in the dark.
Don't worry, he said soothingly. They'll take forever to reach the Grey Range. Ask Goimgar how long they needed to get here.
They're not traveling on foot, Boendar broke in. They've all vanished except Bislapur, and no one knows where they've gone.
They didn't go through the gates, added Boindil.
Suddenly it dawned on Tungdil.
Svet!
In an instant he was wide awake. Bislapur's gnome had followed them and eavesdropped on their conversation until Boindil had scared him away.
Which means Gandagar knows exactly how to operate the rails.
Svert was every bit as devious as his master. Tungdil wriggled into his leather jerkin and pulled on his mail, leather breeches and boots. At last he was ready for the adventure to begin. He told Bavrogor and Goimgar to follow the twins through the disused passageways and light the fires beneath the cauldrons.
I want the wagons to be on the rails by the time I get there. I've got a thing or two to say to Bislapur first.
He asked Belendilin to accompany him.
I see you've chosen your mason, the councillor remarked.
Not exactly, Tungdil sighed. Bavrogor volunteered himself and I fell for it. It's too late to go back on my word, but I wouldn't mind knowing why everyone is so against him. Is his drinking really that bad?
Belendilin drew breath.
Either he's sober, in which case he's bitter and rancorous, or he's tipsy, which means he won't stop singing and playing the clown, the merry minstrel they call him. As far as his masonry is concerned, he's past his peak.
You mean he's not the best mason?
Oh, he's the best, all right. You only need look at the parapets, halls, and passageways to convince yourself of that. But Bavrogor hasn't used his chisel for 10 cycles or more. Thanks to his perpetual drinking, his hands can't be trusted to do what his mind commands. No other mason has ever come close to rivaling his art. So yes, he's the best.
He pursed his lips.
I didn't want to recommend him because his mood is unpredictable and he may not be as skilled as he was. Either way, it's not worth dwelling on now.
They found Bislapur breakfasting in the dining hall with a group of Forthling delegates. His companions broke off their whispered conversation to warn him of Tungdil and Belendilin's approach.
Still here? Said Bislapur, feigning surprise. I expected more of you, Tungdil. Strike while the iron is hot. Isn't that the smith's motto?
I was waiting for Gandagar, retorted Tungdil, struggling to contain his rage. Why isn't he here? And who told him how to get to the tunnels?
Bislapur eyed him dismissively.
We did some exploring of our own, he said casually. Besides, there was no agreement about departing together. Gandagar and his company were ready, so they left. They'll be back with Keenfire before too long.
He wrinkled his nose.
You're the one who spent last night in his cups and frittered away the morning in bed. You should be setting Bavrogor an example, not the other way round.
Then let the race begin.
We'll soon see who gets to the Firstling Kingdom and recruits the best smith. Your monarch will be wishing he'd had more of a lead.
Bislipur picked up his mug of hot milk.
Well, don't let me delay you. You're free to go whenever you please.
There was a rumble of laughter from his companions.
Where's that gnome of yours?
Belendolin asked sharply.
I hope he isn't snooping on your behalf. He wouldn't be plotting anything untoward against Tungdil, would he?
Bislipur jumped to his feet and drew himself up threateningly.
How dare you insult my honour, Belendolin One-Arm? If you had enough limbs to defend yourself, I'd challenge you to a duel.
You can guarantee it will come to that if you continue to provoke me, the councillor said evenly. All I want is your assurance that the expedition will be conducted without interference from you.
Bislipur put his hands on his hips.
Vrakas forfend that I should interfere. That's precisely why I stayed behind, so no one would wrongfully accuse me.
And what of your little helper? Demanded Belendolin.
The same applies, Bislipur said haughtily. Of course, I don't always know what he's up to. Sometimes he gives me the slip.
Tungdil didn't believe a word of it.
We'll have to keep our eyes open.
He excused himself brusquely and hurried out of the hall.
So, Bislipur, Belendolin said softly, why don't you tell me why you really stayed behind?
The dwarf laughed balefully.
I've given you one good reason already, but since you insist, I'm here because I don't want you deciding our future if the High King was to die. I owe it to my folk to ensure that the secondlings don't seize the crown while the legitimate heir is away.
He leaned forward.
When I say legitimate heir, I don't mean your puppet. He isn't one of us.
Nonsense, Belendolin said flatly. Tungdil is a fourthling. You heard the evidence just like everyone else.
Bislipur took a step toward him.
I'll tell you where Svert is, he whispered. He's on his way to our kingdom to study our archives and speak with those who would know of a bastard child.
His eyes narrowed.
The story of Tungdil's origins is an outrageous lie, an insult to the honor of a king who was faithful to his queen until his dying orbit.
Svert will bring back proof that your puppet is a liar, a slanderer, and a fraud.
And I shall take pleasure in exposing the deceit. I'll smash the charlatan's ambitions as thoroughly as this axe has splintered hundreds of orcish skulls. Make no mistake, my friend. Everyone involved in this trickery will meet the same fate. I swear it on Vrakas' hammer.
Belendolin considered the threat and decided that Bislipur stood a good chance of uncovering the deceit. If Tungdil was to return victorious, he would have to be protected from the allegations until Nodon was defeated. The crusade against the Magus was more important than anything else.
That's good to know, he said equably. Like you, I'm an honest dwarf, with nothing to fear from the truth. I look forward to seeing which of our candidates is the first to return. In the meantime, I'm sure you won't mind if I examine the authenticity of your document about the elves. I think it's important to establish who was really responsible for the Fifthling's fall. Of course, if the text you provided turns out to be a forgery, I'll know who to blame.
He nodded curtly and left the hall. Bislipur sat down and watched the one-armed councillor disappear into the corridor.
Much good may it do you. Just wait and see who'll soon be sitting on the throne, he muttered darkly.
His ambitious plans had been foiled by the appearance of the impostor, but he had no intention of giving up.
I'm not letting cycles of preparation go to waste. We're going to war, no matter what.
In the event that the delegates changed their minds about a military offensive, he had another trick up his sleeve. Bislipur turned back to the breakfast table to refill his plate. He cut himself a slice of ham and stared at the streaks of white fat amid the soft pink flesh. Suddenly, it came to him.
My enemy's enemies are my friends.
Tungdil threw his most important belongings into a knapsack and hurried down the passageways at a jog. As an afterthought, he had briefed Belendolin and Gundrabur about the 8 rails leading out through the mountain. Gandagar was gone already, but the other delegates deserved to be told of the forgotten depot of wagons and machines.
On reaching the hall, he found his companions awaiting him with faces as long as elves. The air was damp and sticky, and he was perspiring from every pore.
"Someone has gone to great lengths to delay us," Boendal explained grimly. "Take a look at this."
The rail that sloped toward the Firstling Kingdom was lying warped and twisted on the floor. The oppressive warmth came from steam that was escaping from countless perforations in the sides of the cauldrons. Even if it was possible to repair the rail, they had no means of moving the heavy wagons.
"So much for letting the best dwarf win," Boendal said testily. "Although it's flattering that Gandogar feels threatened enough to cheat."
"I'd rather do without that sort of flattery. Besides, I don't suppose Gandogar had anything to do with it." Tungdil bent down and examined the rail more closely. Someone had used the pulley system to prise it from the ground.
"If you ask me, Bislipur decided to give his monarch a helping hand." "What are we supposed to do now?"
Gwimgar had stationed himself a few paces away and was cultivating a detached expression. Meanwhile, Bavrogor was leaning against one of the perforated cauldrons and drinking from his pouch. He licked his lips contentedly, sealed the pouch, and walked over to inspect the damage.
"It's simple, really," he breezed. "All we have to do is swap the rails."
He pointed to the neighboring rail that served as the disembarking point for passengers arriving from the Firstling Kingdom.
"You've been drinking," Boendal said reproachfully.
The mason didn't bother to look at him.
"So what? I don't complain when you've been eating. Beer just happens to be my sustenance."
His huge, calloused hands thumped the metal track.
"We'll send for one of our smiths and let him take care of it."
His right eye settled on the punctured cauldrons.
"As for these, we should fetch a tinker from the trading post. I expect our artisans could handle it, but it's more of a job for a tinker. And while we're at it, we may as well ask the womenfolk in the brewery. They know a good deal about vats."
Tungdil stared at him in surprise. All of a sudden, the one-eyed dwarf was bubbling with enthusiasm and confidence. Belendalin had been right. The mason's mood was unpredictable.
"Good work, Bavrogor. Those are excellent suggestions," he said approvingly.
"I know."
Grinning, the mason rewarded himself with another draught of beer. The combined efforts of the tinker and his apprentices, assisted by the women from the brewery, resulted in the cauldrons being repaired to the point where they could withstand the build-up of steam for long enough to get the machinery going. It took a further two orbits to undo the rest of the damage. At last, the cauldrons were filled with water and fired from below. The gears moved smoothly, and the hoists did as instructed. By the afternoon of the third orbit, their wagon was stationed on its new rail, ready to begin its journey into the unknown. Tungdil and Boindil sat at the front, with Bavrogor and Gwimgar on the next bench and Boendal at the rear. Their luggage, including comestibles, equipment, and the materials for Keenfire, was shared among them and stowed at their feet. Tungdil turned round and scanned the faces of his companions. There was no telling what awaited them at the bottom of the first steep drop, or how much of an advantage Gandogar had gained. Everyone looked understandably grave.
"Trust in Vrakas," he said,
shifting his gaze to focus on the door ahead. His left hand grasped the lever beside the rail. He pulled it back, and the door swung open, clearing their passage into the darkness ahead.
"And now to save Gurdlegard!"
He let up on the brakes, and the wagon rolled gently down the ramp toward the tunnel.
"What if Gandogar sabotaged the rail?"
Gwimgar asked anxiously.
"Or what if we're too heavy and fly off the side?"
"Let's hope we don't find out."
There was a crazed glint in Boindil's eyes as they rushed toward the final pitch.
"Here we come!"
Gathering speed, the wagon reached the point where the tunnel took a sudden plunge. Its passengers held on tightly as the vehicle tipped over the edge and careered into the abyss. Iahart whooped in excitement. Boendal held on for dear life. Bavrogor burst into song, and Gwimgar petitioned Vrakas, while Tungdil wondered whether any of his companions were sane.
Chapter 12. Underground Network, Gurdlegard, Late Autumn, 6234th Solar Cycle.
The windswept dwarves sped through the tunnel, hair and beards streaming behind them as the wagon thundered along the rail, swooping and juddering at an incredible rate. The speed of the descent pinned them to their seats, and Tungdil felt himself being pushed and pulled in ways he had never thought possible. Bavrogor had stopped singing after choking on something that had flown into his mouth, leaving Boindil to whoop and bellow with untrammeled enthusiasm, exhilarated by the stomach-turning ride. Goimgar was praying with his eyes closed and beseeching Vrakas to protect him from harm. His mortal terror betrayed a lack of confidence in Gandagar's sense of fair play. The carefully hewn walls flashed past so rapidly that all they could see was a blur of polished stone. After a while, the tunnel opened out, becoming at least as wide as the wagon was long.
"You'll burst my eardrums if you keep yelling like that," Boindil told his twin. "It's even noisier at the back because of the wind."
Boindil roared with laughter.
"Ha ha! Isn't this fun? It's a million times faster than boring old ponies. I'd like to shake our forefathers by the hand." "I don't know," grumbled Bavrogor, wiping brandy from his eyes. "They could have made it a bit easier for me to drink."
Tungdil smiled quietly. Being with other dwarves almost made up for the ordeals he had suffered since leaving Ionandar, and he had no regrets about visiting Ogre's death, even though it meant embarking on another trip. At least this time he wouldn't be traveling alone.
"If only it weren't for their blasted feuding," he said, not realizing that he was speaking aloud.
"Blasted what?"
Boindil bellowed.
"Speak up! I can't hear you!"
Tungdil gave a helpless shrug. Their steep slide into darkness ended as abruptly as it had begun, and they continued at a more agreeable pace, with a few gradual climbs and the occasional gentle downhill. They clattered over two junctions without being thrown off the rail.
"I hope we're on the right track,"
called Boindil from the rear.
"Has anyone seen any signposts?"
"I saw some levers before both sets of points," Tungdil shouted back. "There was dust and lichen all over them. I don't think anyone's used them for some time."
He hoped to goodness he was right. The tunnel stopped widening, and the view, now that they had slowed enough to see it, was disappointingly monotonous. Save for the odd patch of lichen or moss, the walls were smooth and unchanging. Twice they spotted stalagmites on the rail. Then the wagon ran over them, snapping them in two.
"There's your proof that Gandagar didn't come this way," said Bavrogor,
uncorking his leather drinking pouch and using the leisurely tempo to drink a few sips before the next descent.
"Do you think they might have switched the points?"
"No," Tungdil said firmly. "The levers definitely hadn't been touched."
"Where else could they have gone, though?"
"Maybe they lifted the wagon across the rails so we wouldn't be able to tell,"
surmised Boindil. Tungdil didn't argue, but privately he was wondering whether Gandagar's company had taken an entirely different route.
"What if they found another tunnel that will get them there more quickly?"
It was conceivable that Gandagar had come into possession of a proper map that showed more than just entrances and exits. Then again, maybe Bavrogor was right, and the points had been changed so that he and the others had been tricked into traveling in the wrong direction, while Gandagar and his companions raced west. He decided not to mention his concerns. Meanwhile, the wagon was purring along the rail, as if it had been making the journey every orbit for 100 cycles. In time, the tunnel widened again, and they reached a vast hall that served as an interchange with 3 other rails. They rolled to a halt. Tungdil jumped down stiffly.
"Come on, you lot, let's see where we go from here."
He was glad of the chance to stretch his legs after hours of sitting down. Between them, they explored the hall and discovered an array of hoists and cauldrons similar to the setup in the Secondling Kingdom.
"It's a kind of junction," murmured Boindil,
shouldering his crow's beak. He scanned the hall to make sure nothing had taken up residence in the underground network without the dwarves' knowledge.
"Hey, Shimmerbeard, what are you doing?"
boomed Boindil. The fourthling sprang away from the wall, revealing a tablet of light grey granite. It was roughly the height and width of a gnome, and held in place with long, rusty nails. He cleared his throat.
"I was wiping the dust away," he said defiantly. "I wanted to see what it said."
"It looks like a map,"
said Tungdil, hurrying over. Well done, Goimgar. You've got sharp eyes. He knew the fourthling didn't deserve his praise. Goimgar had been scratching out the lines with his dagger to disadvantage the expedition and allow the fourthling king to get ahead. Tungdil had no means of actually proving it, so he kept the observation to himself and made a quick sketch of the map.
I'll have to keep an eye on him.
Look, Tungdil,
Bavrigor said cheerfully.
We're on the right track. It's this way.
That's all we need. Directions from a one-eyed dwarf,
muttered Goimgar, just loud enough for Bavrigor to hear. The mason turned on him, snarling with rage. His right hand shot out, his fingers winding their way into the artisan's wavy beard and pulling him close.
Come here, you pathetic excuse for a dwarf,
he growled, raising his free hand and peeling back his left eyelid to expose the shriveled remains of an eye. A shard of rock was impaled at its center.
You think I'm blind, do you? Ha! Let me tell you about my eye. One orbit, the mountain tired of my masonry and exacted its revenge. A splinter of rock, as sharp and fine as a needle, flew up and robbed me of my sight. But Vrakas took pity on me and made the other eye 10 times as strong. That's 10 times, Shimmerbeard! My one eye sees more clearly than 10.
He pushed the delicate artisan away and laughed grimly.
It sees the slightest flaw in the rock, the pores of your skin, and the fear in your eyes. What do you have to say about that?
Goimgar backed away from the mason's mighty hands and rubbed his chin. He had endured the humiliation silently, but now that Bavrigor had released him, he felt brave enough to vent his fury in a threat.
You'll regret this, Hammerfist. Just wait until Gandagar is High King. The mountain won't be the only one to exact revenge.
That's right. Run to Gandagar. You're a coward as well as a weakling.
Let's call it quits now, Tungdil said sharply. You've both said more than enough.
In fact, Goimgar's threat about Gandagar being High King was proof that he intended the expedition to fail.
I don't want to hear another insult from either of you. In any case, it's time to go.
He strode back to the wagon, the other four following in silence. The strained atmosphere was a worrying portent for the company's future.
What happens when I can't stop them from quarreling?
His spirits sank lower when he remembered that Bavrigor and Goimgar weren't the only ones at loggerheads. Boindil and Bavrigor couldn't stand each other either. Only the calm and practical Boendal hadn't made any enemies.
Who knows how long that will last? It's not easy being a leader, he thought gloomily. Vrakas, give me strength.
Boindil, ever hopeful of finding someone or something to fight, wandered over to the mouth of the tunnel. He opened the door and peered inside.
It goes straight down. The wagon will need a bit of a push, then the slope will take care of the rest.
The next leg of the journey awaited them. They hauled their vehicle to the top of the ramp and jumped aboard, save for Boendal, who waited a moment longer to give them a final shove. Soon they were hurtling westward, squeaking and rattling through the tunnel to the kingdom of Borengar's folk. Enchanted Realm of Leos Nudin, Gerdlegard, Late Autumn, 6234th Solar Cycle. The scouts returned on horseback with news that Perista was going about its usual business, untroubled by the twin-flanked advance of 40,000 soldiers under the command of Gerdlegard's finest human warriors. Gentle sunshine bathed the lush green countryside, bringing out the rich autumn hues of the trees. Everywhere the foliage was putting on a last show of splendor before the winter frosts. All the same, the air was decidedly chilly, so Tilligorn and Lothair had erected an assembly tent to guard against the winds. They stood outside and listened to the scout's report. The first envoy sent to Perista to negotiate on their behalf had returned with a list of preposterous demands, not to mention tidings of the Magi's deaths. Many orbits had passed since then, but the brief exchange had taught them that Nodon was the real enemy and would have to be destroyed. Clasping flasks of hot tea, the kings of Idoslane and Urgon studied the sketched map of fortifications and marveled at Perista's meager defenses. A single wall protected the city from attack. Tilligorn was wearing plain but solid armor. He was heartened to see Parista's vulnerability. There were villages in his kingdom that were better defended than the capital of Nadon's realm.
"Victory will be swift, provided the Magus doesn't jinx us. We made the right decision in not waiting for reinforcements.
Between us, we'll bring the villain to his knees. He can't be in two places at once. One of the gates will fall, and Parista will be ours,"
Lothair said confidently, checking the buckles on his lightweight leather mail. Each was wearing armor in keeping with the style of combat in his kingdom. In Eidoslane, Tilligorn was accustomed to fighting heavily armed and powerful orcs, which called for heavy-duty protection against axes and swords, whereas a solid suit would be impractical in Urgon because of the lakes and hills. Agility and speed were of the essence when death was the likely consequence of stumbling on a narrow mountain pass. The mismatched sovereigns were in command of an army that was similarly diverse. Each of the 7 human kingdoms had sent units to Parista, but the other monarchs were content to let Tilligorn and Lothair direct the motley troops. Another 40,000 soldiers were already on their way, ready for the next stage in the campaign, the assault on Sion Balsur. Queen Umilante had sent her lightly armored and sparely clad warriors to line up with Queen Wei IV's water guards and Queen Asika's guerrillas, whose favored territory was the forest. Not a soldier among them had ever stormed a city, and so it fell to Lothair's and Tilligorn's units, who, along with King Nate's cavalry, formed the mainstay of the army to show them what to do.
"It's a good thing we're attacking Parista first. The men could use the experience before they cross blades with the Alfar."
Lothair pointed to the city gates.
"Tilligorn, you attack the northern gate. I'll approach from the south. The catapults and ladders are ready and waiting."
He held his head high.
"I'll go in first. Take up position with your 20,000 men, but don't advance straight away. As soon as you see my signal, charge through the other gate and attack the palace from the north."
"Agreed."
Tilligorn reached for his helmet.
"Then let's rid Gerdlegard of Nadon. After that, we can focus on routing the Alfar and the Orcs. May Palandiel be with us."
"She's with us already, there's no doubt of that."
They shook hands, mounted their horses, and rode to join their units 3 miles from Parista's walls. Lothair ordered the fanfare to be sounded, and the men raised their standards in a billowing sea of cloth. The divisions attacked from the south as agreed, the first wave of soldiers pushing wheeled screens of wood in front of them to shield their advance. Parista waited until they were within firing distance before waking from its doze. A dark shadow whooshed toward them, arrows and missiles raining on the troops. The men huddled behind their wooden defenses, and all but a handful escaped the storm unscathed. Lothair's archers returned fire, and the advance continued behind the moving screens. The men reached the wall, flipped the panels over, and held them aloft, while others banged posts into the soil, on which to balance the wooden shields. With the makeshift roofs overhead, there was no risk of injury from bombardment from above. Soon, ladders were clattering against the walls. It was then that Nadon gave them a taste of his might. Tilligorn was watching on horseback while his foot soldiers stole toward the northern gates. There was no opposition worth speaking of. Parista's guardians had been tricked into thinking that the opposite side of the city was the focus of the attack. By the time news of a second invasion reached the troops in the south, Tilligorn and his men would be through the northern gates and advancing on the palace.
"We'll soon decide the matter in our favor," he told himself firmly.
There was something unsettling about fighting magic with manpower, but he couldn't think of any other way. Tilligorn had opted to ride at the head of the 5,000-strong cavalry, and he planned to bear down on the palace and take the Magus by storm. In a battle against the wizard's magic, he needed every advantage of speed and shock to survive. 2 lone riders looped toward him, raising their flags as a signal for the king and his units to advance.
"Palandiel, protect us!"
Tilligorn checked each of his weapons, making sure his sword and dagger were at hand. On his orders, the bugles were sounded, heralding the attack. The first 8,000 men swarmed toward the gates like ants. Lothair had used the same tactic on the other side of the city, only 2 miles farther south. The attacking force met with almost no resistance. A few arrows were loosed from the parapets, but the damage was minimal. In no time, ladders had been laid against the walls, and the first of Tilogorn's warriors were scaling the defences to grapple with the handful of plucky soldiers left in charge of the northern gates. Tilogorn watched as Idaslane's flag was raised on the ramparts. He buckled his helmet and pushed down the visor.
For Gurglagard!
He and his 5,000 cavalrymen pounded toward the open gates. The first block detached itself from the parapet and shot toward them like a missile from a catapult. The slab of stone, as long as a forearm in its shortest dimension, struck a soldier in the chest, his body compressing like honeycomb beneath the mass of granite. It was the start of a bombardment more gruesome than anything the men had ever witnessed. Most of them weren't destined to survive it. Block by block, the city wall was coming undone. Starting from the top, the stone slabs hurled themselves from the parapet, hitting the attacking army with such force that neither shields nor armor could save them. The massive projectiles crashed straight through the wooden barricades, flipping them over or smashing them to pieces and showering the nearby troops with a lethal hail of wood and stone. Each of the blocks met its target. Everywhere, armor was shattering, bones splintering, and granite embedding itself in the ground. Shouts of terror gave way to screams for help and the anguished howls of the dying. Soon there was nothing left to support the ladders, and they toppled back among the troops.
"Pull back!"
commanded Lothair, wheeling his horse about. A block struck his stallion's head, and it fell to the ground, twitching. The king tumbled from the saddle and was trapped beneath the fallen mount. When at last he dragged himself free, he realized that his leg was wounded, perhaps broken. Barely able to stand, let alone walk, he was rescued by 2 of his guards, who carried him to a ditch, the only place that offered any protection against the flying granite.
"Curse the Magus and his wizardry," muttered Lothair, gritting his teeth as pain shot through his injured leg.
The situation was worse than anything he had imagined. Nodon was using his terrible powers to bring death and destruction to the allied troops. He tried not to think about the quantity of blocks in the wall. It was a formidable arsenal by anyone's standards. At last, when the thudding and pounding had ceased, the king raised his head and looked out of the ditch. The flat ground at the foot of the gates was littered with stone slabs of varying sizes. Even the base blocks, each the length of a fully grown man, had lifted from the foundations and hurled themselves at the troops. Limbs, broken lances, warped shields, and snapped spears protruded from beneath the masonry, the hunks of stone providing grisly markers for every corpse. Lothair's gaze travelled over the debris and settled on the unprotected streets and houses beyond. Bereft of its wall, the capital of Lyos Nudin lay defenceless before him. Only the watchtowers on either side of the gates were still in place.
"This is our chance," he said, straining to speak through the pain. "We've got to attack!"
With the help of his guards, he left the trench to spur on his army. Barely 3,000 of his 20,000 men had survived the bombardment, and over half of those had taken flight, their courage defeated by the invisible malice at work.
"Who can blame them?" he thought bitterly.
The sight of their leader strengthened the soldiers' resolve, and Lothair was soon surrounded by a loyal cohort of 1,500 men, all determined to invade the city and storm the palace. Just then, the masonry came back to life. The biggest blocks were the first to move, rising one by one and lowering themselves into position. Next came the smaller slabs, piling one on top of the other, until the wall loomed once again above the horrified troops. Only this time, it glistened red with the blood of their comrades. That was the moment when Lothair stopped believing that Nodon could be defeated. Lowering himself onto the blood-drenched grass, he stared at the insurmountable obstacle in their path. Fragments of armor, broken weaponry, and mutilated body parts stuck to the wall like trophies, daring the army to launch another doomed assault.
"Ye gods, what can I do?"
Weapons at the ready, his soldiers hesitated. Lothair was still praying for inspiration when the voice of the Magus sounded from above.
How thoughtful of you to bring me an army, King Lothair.
Enjoy your monstrous work while you can,
Urgon's ruler shouted furiously.
Your cruel dominion will soon be over.
There was a flash of dark green cloth, and the Magus came into view through an embrasure. Lothair looked up at the great white oval of his bloated face.
You thought you were invading a defenseless city. It wasn't your only mistake. The human eye is easily misled.
He raised his arms and gestured with an elegance belying his bulk.
All the best with your final battle, King Lothair. Don't worry. This time you'll be fighting humans, not stones.
He withdrew and disappeared behind a merlon. On looking round, Lothair was rooted with horror. The grass beneath him was turning grey before his eyes. All around him, the trees were drooping, the branches shedding their richly coloured leaves, whose pigment faded as they fell. This was the true face of Leos Nudin, disguised by the Magus to trick them into setting foot in the perished land. Lothair knew what it meant for him and his 1,500 men.
The perished land knows no such thing as death.
Lothair had heard stories about the northern pestilence, and the thought of it made him shudder with horror. Closing his eyes, he prayed to Palandiel and other benevolent deities to deliver them from their fate. His desperate prayers were cut short by the sound of low groans from all over the battlefield. The dead soldiers were rising, clambering clumsily out of block-shaped craters and pushing their way through shattered blockades. Depending on the extent of their injuries, they crawled, limped, or staggered toward the surviving troops. A few walked without impediment, but their open wounds and terrible deformities gave them away. Already there were 100 of them, each clutching a sword, lance, or other weapon, and their ranks were swelling all the time.
But it's impossible! What are we to do?
Cried a terrified officer.
We fight our way out, ruled Lothair. If we stay, our courage will be of no greater use to anyone than it was to these men. The perished land will enslave us. We'll head south.
His loyal guards had been waiting for his signal and offered him their shoulders to lean on. A dozen warriors surrounded the trio and shielded the wounded king.
Make haste, and may Palandiel be with us.
With that, Lothair and his men surged forward to break through the ring of undead soldiers who had once been their allies. The cavalry thundered through the deserted streets of Perista with no regard for their own limbs or the safety of their mounts. Tearing round the corners, many of the horses skidded on the treacherous cobblestones and careened into houses. Those behind leapt over the bodies and galloped on. Their goal was already in sight. Towering above the rest of the city, Nodon's palace, once the seat of the council of the Magi, pointed them on their way. To Tilagorn's relief, the citizens of Perista did nothing to halt the charge. The assault on the gates had gone according to plan, and now the invaders could focus on the purpose of their mission, subduing the Magus himself. The king trusted entirely to the power of numbers, believing his army to be stronger and more powerful than any wizard's spell. To think otherwise would be irresponsible. The men would sense his hesitation, and an anxious army was easy to defeat. The riders streamed through Perista like a torrent of shimmering water, channeled by the streets into three separate tributaries, which flowed toward the palace walls and collected in the marketplace outside the palace gates. Ahead of them, a crowd of people had gathered in front of the entrance. Judging by their dress, they were ordinary citizens, mainly women and children, who barred the way without weaponry or aggression. From the throng of 300 souls, an unarmed youth stepped forward with his hands in the air.
Leave the Magus in peace, men of the East, he called. He has done nothing to hurt you and wishes you no harm.
Prince Malin, clad in the armor of the Ido dynasty, pushed his mount through the rows of horses and drew alongside Tilagorn.
Nodon has bewitched them, he whispered urgently. Break them up or we'll lose our advantage.
He glanced nervously at the turrets.
We're a sitting target out here.
Prince Malin? Didn't Lothair?
The attack failed. Gerdlegard is depending on you and your men.
I was right to fear the wizard's magic.
He sat up tall in the saddle.
Move aside, good people. Our quarrel is with Nodon, not you.
You can trample us into the ground if you like,
their spokesman retorted.
You'll have to kill us if you want to get past.
He turned his back to them and returned to the others, who closed ranks, leaving no room for a horse to pass. Tilagorn ordered 300 riders to advance in a line and push the crowd through the gates. The row of armored horses bore down on the townspeople like a wall of steel, pushing them aside, while a second line of cavalrymen prevented them from rushing back to the entrance. Suddenly, one of the riders tumbled from his horse, clutching his leg and howling in pain. A moment later, a citizen of Perista took his place in the saddle and whipped out a cudgel spiked with nails. The unsuspecting rider to the left was struck in the face before the right-hand neighbor could reach across and run the intruder through. As the young man fell, his simple garments disintegrated, revealing an armor-plated orc. The snarling beast hit the ground and died. With that, the spell was broken, and the unarmed crowd became a war band of orcs. It was conclusive proof, if any were needed, that Nodon was in league with Teon and his minions.
"Cut them down!" shouted Tilagorn. "Kill every last one of them! It's an illusion!"
The formerly peaceful crowd hurled themselves on the cavalry, attacking the horses and riders with cudgels, axes, and notched swords. Thrown off guard by the transformation, dozens of soldiers were killed. On recovering from the initial shock, the riders discovered that it was impossible to land an accurate blow amid the jostling bodies. They endeavored to leave the scrum. The green-hided beasts chased after them, hacking at the horses' legs, slashing their flanks, and hanging off their manes like rabid dogs, until the poor animals bolted in agony and terror. Wild with panic, the horses charged the waiting units, and the chaos was complete. Meanwhile, the orcs were everywhere, snarling, striking, and ducking out of sight. The horses kicked out, making no distinction between friend and foe, whinnying, snorting, and pawing until they were seized by an overwhelming urge to flee. Even the best riders were unable to stop the stampede. The instincts of the herd were stronger than any bridle or spurs. Malin and Tilagorn lost valuable time as they struggled to round up their men and regroup in the marketplace. By then, the foot soldiers had arrived and were readying themselves to join the charge through the gates. In the blink of an eye, the orcs disappeared, leaving only the dead and wounded as evidence that a savage confrontation had occurred. The two commanders didn't stop to worry about the whereabouts of the enemy, but gave the order for the gates to be breached. 3,000 riders tore into the palace forecourt. Tilagorn dispatched the units in different directions, and the search for Nodon began. Racing up the broad, flat steps, the horses sped through the corridors and halls, unimpeded by defenders or orcs.
"Stay down here and continue the search,"
Tilagorn instructed the bulk of his men. He eyed the highest turret, where his instincts told him that Nodon would be waiting.
"I'm going up there!"
He dismounted and wound his way up the flight of stairs, with Malin and 300 men. As the staircase narrowed and steepened, he lifted his visor so he could breathe. On entering the first chamber, he glanced at the large window through which the southern streets of the city could be seen. An armed unit was heading for the palace, the flags of Urgon and their other allies fluttering in the breeze.
"Look, Malin,"
he said, relieved to see the reinforcements.
"King Lothair has taken the gates. The wizard is at our mercy."
The fair-haired prince of Ido stared in astonishment.
"But Lothair was... I thought I saw him..."
He trailed off, puzzled, and followed the king. Buoyed by new courage and energy, they strode down the corridor until they came to an imposing door, which they opened by force. Their persistence was rewarded. 20 paces away, a colossal figure in dark green robes was standing with his back to them. The Magus was studying the commotion at the base of the turret and didn't turn around. Without waiting for Tilagorn's order, the men spread out and silently leveled their bows. The target was so broad that it seemed the arrows couldn't fail to hit their mark. But on nearing the Magus's back, the tips rusted, the shafts disintegrated, and wood dust trailed through the air. Soon nothing remained but fragments of metal, which tinkled against the marble floor.
"Welcome, King Tilagorn,"
the Magus greeted them, his back still turned.
You have entered the enchanted realm of Leos Nodon. What brings you here?
The plight of our kingdoms, Tilogorn replied steadily, drawing his weapon in readiness for a duel. You are a danger to Gerdlegard.
And you, King Tilogorn, have invaded my realm, stormed my palace, and threatened my life. Should I consider you a danger?
You're a traitor, Nodon. A murderer and a traitor.
A murderer, yes, that much is true. But I killed only because I had to, because I wanted to save Gerdlegard, like you. Humankind is facing a much greater danger, a danger that only my friend and I are powerful enough to combat. And for that we need mastery over Gerdlegard. The races of men, elves and dwarves must cede their lands for the greater good, or die.
Turning at last, he looked at them sadly, with watery green eyes.
It pains me greatly that some have chosen death already. You'll join me, won't you?
He took a step toward Tilogorn and held out his hand.
Never!
The king signaled for his men to attack, and a dozen soldiers stormed forward. They were still charging when their weaponry, mail, clothes, flesh and bones perished like the arrows. The unseen power worked so swiftly that there was no opportunity for them to retreat. A semicircle of dust surrounded the Magus, 4 paces from his feet. Then an autumn gust dispersed the disintegrating men. The remaining soldiers drew back in fear.
You underestimated my power, King Tilogorn, the Magus said slowly. You refused a hand extended in friendship. Your men are paying for your arrogance.
The fresh wind carried the sound of fighting to Tilogorn's ears. He listened intently.
You thought the battle was over, did you?
Nodon gestured to the window.
Why don't you see for yourself what has become of King Lothair and his men?
Tilogorn kept the Magus in his sights and sent a soldier to the window to report on the skirmish below.
They're fighting our men, he said in consternation. The soldiers are waving Urgon's banners, but they're joining forces with the orcs,
he gasped.
Palandio, have mercy on us! The dead soldiers are rising, they're still alive, and they're killing our troops!
Nodon chuckled.
You have been treading the perished land for some time, King Tilogorn. I created the illusion to draw you to me, and sure enough, you brought me the army I desired.
He broke off mid-speech, racked by violent coughing. Blood dribbled from his lips, and 2 dark streams formed beneath his nostrils. He sank to his knees, still spluttering, and more blood gushed from his mouth, forming a crimson pool on the immaculate marble floor.
This is our chance! Shouted Tilogorn, rushing toward him. For Gerdlegard!
His soldiers joined the charge. Most of the valiant warriors were turned to dust, but the Magus's weakness had damaged his magic shield. 30 men, among them King Tilogorn, penetrated his guard and were able to attack. 3, then 4 arrows embedded themselves in the bloated body, and the soldiers rushed in, hacking at Nodon's prostrate form. Seconds later, Prince Malin joined the fray. Terrified that they too would fall prey to some wizardry, the men attacked with preternatural force. Their arms rose and fell in a savage frenzy, the blows raining harder and faster all the time. Blood seeped from every inch of the mutilated body, washing over the floor and poisoning the air. Tilogorn saw a flicker of movement in the open wounds.
There's something alive in there,
he realized with a shudder. He threw all his strength behind his blade.
Die, why don't you?
No!
Screeched Nodon. Even as he spoke, a gust of wind swept his assailants off their feet, knocking them backward.
Gerdlegard will be ruined without me!
Black lightning shot from the onyx on his staff, zigzagging in all directions and incinerating the flesh and armor of all in its path.
Don't listen to him!
Tilogorn sprang forward and raised his sword.
Keep fighting!
He gasped. His right arm swooped toward the Magus.
Keep!
A bolt raced toward him and seared through his armor, piercing his heart. With a groan, he sank down and let go of his sword, which clattered to the ground and disappeared among the muddle of legs and feet. He was filled with a sense of crushing failure.
"Congratulations, Prince Malin," Nodon said mockingly. "I suppose this makes you Eidoslane's new king."
He stepped forward and made to shake his hand.
"The question is, will you join me, or lose your kingdom as quickly as you gained it?"
The last of the Eidos didn't stop to consider. Picking up Tilagorn's sword, he helped the wounded king to his feet.
"Let's go," he said to Tilagorn. "We'll deal with Nodon another time."
He dragged the monarch to the door, protected by a guard of men. The Magus watched incredulously.
"Not you as well!"
"How could I ally myself with Eidoslane's enemy?"
Malin lifted Tilagorn's arm over his shoulder and half-carried, half-propelled him down the stairs. Nodon strode after them.
"Then you shall die together!"
he shouted hysterically.
"You're no use to me!"
A volley of bolts crackled toward them, searing through the last remaining guards. Malin slung Tilagorn over his shoulder and raced down the stairway.
"I'm not leaving you with that monster. I'll get us out of here if it's the last thing I do," he said, gasping under the strain.
"Rule our kingdom more wisely than your forebears."
Tilagorn was fading, his voice little more than a whisper. A trickle of blood leaked out of his mouth and onto the prince's armor.
"Listen carefully. Wait for the other units at a safe distance from Parista. Rescue the wounded, and be sure to burn the dead. If you don't, he'll face an army of revenants that nothing and no one can defeat. Whatever happens, Nodon mustn't be granted his invincible undead."
"You can't die on me, Tilagorn. I need you to help me exact our revenge."
The prince had to fight for breath as he struggled beneath the extra weight.
"Don't tell me you're prepared to leave your kingdom to an Eido,"
he said harshly, hoping to stir the king's anger and galvanize his will to live.
"What's the matter with you, Tilagorn?"
"Promise me you'll make a better king than your grandfather. Promise that you won't tear Eidoslane apart."
"You have my word."
"Burn the dead," the king whispered. "You must save Eidoslane. Pelandialbi."
The tension left his body.
"I shall honor my promise, Tilagorn of Eidoslane."
Malin laid the body gently at the foot of the turret.
"To regain the throne at such a price."
He took the dead king's sword, clasp, and signet ring, and ran on. It was only through sheer determination and good fortune that he and his remaining men escaped the violent fury of the revenants. As they left the city, they set fire to the buildings, creating a sea of flames that no amount of wizardry could contain. Even the rain invoked by Nodon could not prevent Parista from being razed to the ground, leaving nothing save the palace and the foundations. King Lothair and King Tilagorn were never to rise from the blaze. Chapter 13. Underground Network, Gurdlagard, Late Autumn, 6234th Solar Cycle. By now, the five dwarves had a rough sense of how far they were from their destination. At first, they hadn't noticed the numerals on the tunnel walls, marking the completion of each 25-mile stretch. In no time, they covered an incredible 200 miles. After a while, they rolled to a halt in another large hall and decided to rest for a few hours before embarking on the next descent. Traveling by wagon was less tiring than walking, but their muscles were sore after hours of sitting uncomfortably and being thrown from side to side. Even the constant rattling was wearying after a while. Bowindel told the others to stay seated while he stood on top of the wagon and scanned the dusty floor for prints.
"Either they've been pulverized, or no one's been this way in ages," he said.
He jumped down and vanished in a thick grey cloud. Bowendal thought for a moment.
"The rail doesn't look especially clean. Gandagard must have taken a different route."
Tungdil unfolded the map he had sketched in the previous hall.
"It's possible, I suppose." "I hope the ceiling collapses on top of him," scowled Bowindel,
searching the hall for firewood. He found a stash of abandoned timber, but it turned to dust in his hands. There would be no melted cheese on toasted mushrooms after all. They ate their meal in silence, each absorbed in his thoughts. Bavrigor took long draughts from his drinking pouch and eventually burst into song, ignoring his companion's objections. His powerful voice reverberated through the hall, echoing down the tunnels.
"For pity's sake, be quiet! We don't want every creature below the surface knowing that we're here," snapped Goimgar.
Boendal grinned.
"I don't think it's much of a secret. He hasn't stopped warbling since we left."
"Poor little Shimmerbeard,"
teased Boindil, laying his axes in his lap and setting to work with his grindstone.
"You're not scared, are you? Don't worry, my brother and I are here to protect you."
He tested each blade with his thumb.
"It's a long time since they tasted orc flesh. They're almost as impatient as me."
"Orc flesh? Down here?"
Goimgar asked anxiously.
"Who can tell?"
the secondling replied. But when Dahl and Tungdil saw the strange glint in his eyes and knew at once that he meant to have some fun, the poor artisan was about to be scared witless.
"The tunnels have been abandoned for hundreds of cycles. All kinds of creatures could have moved in without us knowing."
He tapped out a noisy rhythm with the butts of his axes.
"It won't be safe until we get rid of them. From now on, it's war."
"That's enough, mighty warrior," Tungdil warned him. Boindil laughed, spurred on by his fiery spirit.
"Show yourselves, you ogres, trolls, orcs, and beasts of Teon! Come out and be hacked to pieces by the children of the smith!"
He had to shout at the top of his voice to drown out the mason's singing.
"Come out, so I can kill you!"
"Don't provoke them,"
Goimgar pleaded, edging away until he was sitting with his back against the wall.
"You shouldn't bait them like that!"
"Someone once told me about hideous beasts that live down here and plague the dwarves,"
said Bavrigor, joining in the fun. He oiled his throat with another helping of whatever he kept in his mysterious pouch.
"Teon created them as our natural enemies, like he created the Alfar to wipe out the elves. Someone once told me about innocent creatures dying in agony because of your singing," quipped Boendal. "More than likely," said his brother. "You'd better keep your mouth shut, Bavrigor. I won't have you chasing away my orcs."
The mason gesticulated rudely and launched into another rousing song, only to be silenced by Tungdil.
"We need to know if anything's sneaking up on us," he explained.
Goimgar and the twins hastened to agree.
"All right, you win."
Bavrigor lowered his voice to a hum and curled up in his blankets. Soon he was snoring at a volume to rival his singing. The twins settled down for the night, but Goimgar stayed exactly where he was. At last, Tungdil handed him a blanket, since he clearly intended to sleep with his back against the wall.
"I saw what you were up to," he said softly when he was sure that the others were asleep.
"I don't know what you mean."
"You know, when we stopped in the other hall, you were trying to ruin the map so we wouldn't be able to read it. Why?"
The diminutive fourthling glared at him defiantly.
"I was dusting it."
"Not with the tip of your dagger, you weren't."
Tungdil looked at him intently and tried to meet his eye.
"I wish you'd stop seeing me as the enemy."
"Don't flatter yourself,"
the artisan said coldly.
"You're not the enemy. You're nobody, not even a fourthling. You can say what you like about your lineage. All I know is you're not one of us. If you want my opinion, you're a common thief who's trying to steal the throne, and I won't let you get away with it. I know what King Gandagar said about obeying your orders, but I'll see to it personally that the rightful heir is crowned."
"Is that why you didn't want to join the expedition?"
"Maybe. Or maybe I don't like travelling, fighting, and enduring all kinds of unpleasantness when I'd rather be at home. The journey to Ogre's death was bad enough, but now I'm risking my life for a liar."
"This isn't about being made High King," Tungdil said earnestly. "Frankly, the whole business is rather a bore."
Goimgar looked at him in astonishment.
"Then why are you here?"
"All I care about is forging Keenfire so we can fight Nodon and put a stop to the evil. Girdlegard is in danger, and we dwarves are the only ones who can save her inhabitants from the Magus' deadly scheme. That's what I'm interested in, not the throne."
"How do I know you're not lying? In your position, I'd swear blind that my beard was blue and the mountain was made of cheese. And besides, what if we get to Ogre's death first? According to the rules of the contest, you'd have to be king. I don't see why we're hurrying if you're not interested in the throne.
Tungdil could tell that the discussion was going nowhere. It would take more than a single knight to convince Goimgar that he was mistaken about his intentions. The Fourthling didn't trust him one bit. In any case, Tungdil didn't like to be reminded about the uncertainty of his ancestry. All his efforts were focused on playing the part of the long-lost heir, but deep down he felt lonely and confused. It was only the thought of Lothaeonan and Frala that gave him the strength to keep pretending. He would do anything to lead the company to the Fifthling Kingdom, so that Keenfire could rob Nodon of his power and his life.
"There's no point arguing," he said glumly. "You should get some sleep. I'll keep watch."
He wrapped himself in a blanket to ward off the underground cold. At that moment he heard something. It sounded like a single strike of a hammer on rock. Goimgar stopped fussing with his bedding and froze.
"An ogre,"
he whispered tremulously.
"Or the ghost of a dwarf who died here when the tunnels were being built."
Tungdil made no reply.
"It could be anything," he thought.
Reaching for his axe, he listened to the darkness. There was silence.
"It was probably just a stone,"
he said slowly, relaxing his vigil.
"A bit of stone falling from the ceiling and hitting the floor. It's nothing to worry about."
"Shouldn't we wake the twins? I bet they'd know what to do."
"It was nothing," Tungdil said firmly. "Forget it and go to sleep."
Goimgar pulled up his blanket until his beard was completely hidden, then balanced his shield across his chest. Tungdil heard him draw his sword. At last the artisan decided that it was safe to close his eyes. Tungdil rose quietly and paced up and down, listening at the mouths of the tunnels for footsteps or any sound of movement.
"I wonder what it could have been."
Silence. The underground network was at peace. Even so, his uneasiness remained.
"There's no reason why other creatures shouldn't have occupied the tunnels."
He hoped to goodness that Boindil's bluster hadn't elicited an unfavorable response. Tungdil waited until they were back in the wagon before telling the others what he and Goimgar had heard. Boindil was torn between excitement and pique, thrilled at the thought of possible antagonists, but angry with Tungdil for letting him sleep. He made a show of sulking and refused to say a word. The wagon tore through the tunnels like the wind, accelerating, slowing, rolling uphill and swooping back down. Twice they ran out of momentum and had to push the vehicle to the next downward slope. For Bavrogor, the interludes were an excuse to belt out a stirring melody, presumably to lift their spirits while they toiled. To make matters worse, he switched to a mournful love song and succeeded in antagonizing Bawindil so much that he could barely contain his rage.
Anyone would think he was baiting him on purpose.
In fact, Tungdil was under the impression that the brawny mason was throwing just a fraction of his weight behind the wagon in order to make Bawindil take the strain. He took Bavrogor aside and confronted him with his suspicions.
"Of course I'm doing it on purpose," the mason said without batting an eyelid. "I want him to suffer every mile of the way."
Tungdil looked at him reproachfully.
"You know that's not fair."
Bavrogor just shrugged.
"Is it because of your sister?"
The mason glanced back at the twins. Boendal was handing his heavily perspiring and thoroughly exhausted brother some water.
"Yes," he said slowly, taking out his own drinking pouch and removing the bung.
There was an instant smell of brandy. He took a sip and wiped a few stray drops from his jet-black beard.
"Yes," he whispered a second time, staring absently into the distance.
He lowered his head.
"What happened between your sister and Boindil?" Tungdil asked gently.
Bavrogor raised his head slowly. His jaw was clenched, and a single teardrop leaked from his patch and rolled down his cheek. He couldn't speak, so he took another draught.
"Is it because of her that you're drinking yourself to death?"
He put the pouch away.
"No, I drink to forget how good I used to be," he said sadly. "Not that it helps, of course. Every corner of Ogre's death is filled with my masonry. My sculptures and engravings look down at me and mock my useless hands."
He leaned back against the wall and let his gaze sweep the room.
"Do you know why I came on this mission?"
he asked abruptly. Tungdil shook his head.
to get out of Augur's death and never go back.
His hoarse voice was full of drunken earnestness.
I'm tired of being pitied. I want to be remembered as Bavrogor Hammerfist, Mason Extraordinaire, who sculpted the spurs for Keenfire and gave his life for the dwarves. Not as drunken old Bavrogor, whose chisel danced over the rock of its own accord.
He smiled wanly.
I promise to do my bit for the dwarves and for Gerdlegard, but I won't return from the Fifthling Kingdom.
He took another long draught to show that his mind was made up. Tungdil's heart went out to the mason. Bavrogor wasn't the noisy, occasionally rude, but fundamentally cheerful and resilient character he had taken him for.
We can't leave you in the Fifthling Kingdom, he protested, realizing at once how feeble he sounded. We'll need your fists in the fight against Nodom.
Bavrogor reached for his arm and squeezed it tightly.
No, Tungdil. You need warriors like the twins, true fighters whose confidence never falters.
He released his grip.
Don't worry. My hands are steady enough to sculpt the strongest, most beautiful spurs ever fashioned by a dwarven chisel. I'll tell you about my sister another time. For now, I'd like a moment with my pouch.
Tungdil got up and strolled over to the twins, who were snacking on ham and cheese.
Poor Bavrogor.
Boendal had observed the conversation from a distance, but refrained from asking questions because he didn't want Boendal to get wind of the mason's distress. He offered Tungdil a morsel of goat cheese.
Well, scholar, only two more orbits and we'll be in the Firstling Kingdom, assuming we don't have any problems with the wagon.
Gundagar will be there already, Tungdil said gloomily.
For all we know, he might have gone the wrong way.
Boindil laughed and wiped his glistening brow.
I hope his blasted shortcut leads him straight into a fathomless chasm.
Gwimgar glared at him.
You can stare all you like, Boindil
told him, rising to the silent reproach.
The king of the dwarves is sitting right here. Your king is a warmonger, a cowardly...
That's enough, Boindil, Tungdil interrupted. I know you'd rather be fighting than trundling along in a wagon, but you're going to have to keep your temper under control.
He waited until Boindil had finished growling.
Right, let's get going. The sooner the first leg of the journey is over, the better.
He stood up, and the other four followed him to the wagon.
Will they ever stop squabbling?
I wonder what it's like in their kingdom,
mused Boendal, preparing to get the wagon rolling.
The firstlings are supposed to be consummate smiths. Do you think they'll forge me a